There's Lisa Ashwood, who's an independent consultant for Pharmaceutical Compounded located in Copa, Texas. We have Denise Frank, senior associate with Gates Healthcare, longtime pharmaceutical consultant and training specialist. And then we have Brenda Jensen, compounding consultant, LLC, in Sioux City, South Dakota. So with that, I'm going to start off with asking each one to give a little bit of information about themselves, and we can start off with, it looks like Denise is first there, so on the picture. We'll go by that.
Hi, I'm Denise Frank. I'm a pharmacist. I was formerly NABP Accreditation Inspection Services Manager. I had my own store, and I've worked for chain as a manager and district manager. But I've worked in regulatory compliance for about 10 years, specifically with sterile and non-sterile compounding, nuclear pharmacy, and other compounding spots. So if everybody, all the attendees, if you would please mute your microphones. We're getting some little bit of echo and some feedback here. So please mute your microphones. Thank you. Yep. Like we're hearing Martin, we're hearing some of the other ones. So please mute your microphones. Thank you. And so I'm going to hand it over to Brenda Jensen.
Hello, I'm Brenda Jensen. Unfortunately, I'm having a little trouble with my computer and camera right now. I own Compounding Consultants from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and I help compounding facilities across the country with training and compliance. And I also am a USP volunteer since 2013.
And Lisa?
Let me get it. Can you guys hear me now? All right. Lisa Ashworth. I'm an independent consultant. Recently left Children's Hospital of Dallas, where I had been there for over 15 years. Most of my career has been in the adult and pediatric hospital or healthcare system world, where we had retail stores and also inpatient facilities. I've had the opportunity to serve on the USP committee since 2005. I think that's longer than any job I've actually had. So as a volunteer, I think that says a lot. And I've had the opportunity to speak and teach around the world about compounding. It's been really fun. And get to be on the same stage with these two colleagues is really great. So.
Well, from there, I thought this is like a very relaxed roundtable discussion and give you opportunities. We'll give you more opportunities to ask questions via chat. But we'll start off with a few questions I thought might be very important to acknowledge. Some of you know, some of you don't, but it's important to say to answer these questions. So what is the actual date in November to start the new USP requirements?
Well, the date is November 1st that they become official and federally become enforceable. But here's the issue with that. You know, for you to start implementing it, and this is going to be a huge issue, you have to do all one or all the other. You can't phase it in. It does not work that way because everything is interrelated. You can't use these BUDs without this training, without this cleaning, you know, everything has to be together. So you're going to need to pick a date that you're going to switch it over. You're going to need to rewrite your policies and procedures and get those all approved and people trained and then decide when you're going to switch over. And I think, and maybe Lisa or Brenda can elaborate on this, you know, how are you going to rewrite every master formula with the new BUDs? Are you going to do them as they come in? Are you doing them ahead of time? How are you going to archive or mark the ones that have the now incorrect BUDs once you switch over?
Well, you know, Denise, I'll elaborate on that because, you know, you're going to have an SOP for your formulations and what's your flow chart look like? What's your, you know, tree look like when you get a new prescription and you want to do a new formula? What does it look like with your old formulas? I mean, I just came out of a large pediatric healthcare system, and that was one of our thoughts was how are we going to conquer this? When you're, you know, when you have 200 pediatric liquids that you do on a regular basis, then how are you going to conquer it? And I think everybody's got to kind of sit down and put their mind to that paperwork to say, what are we going to do? And it's, I'll just call it the elephant in the room. Okay. You can't do it all in one day. You can't do it all at once. You know, are you going to pick and choose? I'm going to do all the A's in the next 3 or 4 days. We're going to do the B's in the next 3 or 4 days. I don't know what that looks like. Do you pick your top 20, 25, 50, go from there, but you got to have a plan and you got to have it on paper, right?
Absolutely. And even though the date is November 1st, most state boards are allowing, if you want to switch everything over now, as long as you're all one or all the other,
mm-hmm.
they're allowing it.
Cherry pick.
Right. But you cannot cherry pick. You can't be part of one and phase in just part mm-hmm. together. It doesn't work that way. But check with your own state board to know what that is. So you don't have to wait until November 1st and then flip everything over on that day. In most states, you could do that now, but it has to be all one or all the other.
I would say there's some parts of 797, like you could start your surface sampling program, mm-hmm. your monthly surface sample program, write your procedure, write your, you know, SOP, get that program going so that it's not last minute. Cause you know, plates have been on shortage over the last year or two too. And I think those companies are feeling the heat coming. So that would be one thing I would recommend people could go ahead and get started on. You could go ahead and start your aseptic testing of your employees every 6 months.
Yeah, anything that's more stringent that doesn't contradict the current chapter would be fine to get started. It's just that you can't pick the easier, more lenient stuff and start that first without everything else in place.
Well, that's phenomenal information. I mean, it gives people the chance to realize that they can do things ahead of time, but just not, you know, activate them. So what are some of the requirements for compounders to be compliant with? Example, in the USP, is parts of it or everything, or what are the requirements? Can you give me your thoughts on that?
Well, we just said you can't pick and choose.
That's a good start.
But in the chapter itself, there are must and shall, which means you have to do it. And then there are ones that say should. And should means recommended. But, you know, it'll all depend on the interpretation of your own state board. FDA, the shoulds are shoulds. They're not required. They are strongly recommended, and you would need to have a good reason not to do that way. But other than that, you know, when you read through them, so if it says should, that's a recommended, not required. Shall, must, are absolutely required.
Question, who's going to regulate this? Is it the boards of pharmacy? Because when these changes take effect on November 1st, question I have is, how do they regulate something that's going to start November 1st by immediate inspections or how's that going to work? In your thoughts, you know, I'm not saying you know the answer, but at least give us thoughts on that.
Well, I know the Joint Commission for at least hospitals has announced that they will start surveying, you know, on November 1st. There's going to be a window of time there for hospitals between November and January, though, where they don't have their manual completely done for 2024. And so they've said that there'll, you know, be some window there where they're asking a lot more questions than enforcement. But come, I think, pretty much January 1st of 2024, healthcare systems, as far as hospitals, are going to be really held to the chapters.
And sure. Technically, November 1st, FDA mm-hmm. can enforce them.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. And that includes 800 for compounding.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. State boards will choose to enforce it or not, or adopt it or not. It just really depends on the state board. But federally, they're enforceable November 1st.
Yeah, they are.
So for members, we can start with members' questions now if you want. This is a good timing because at least we got a preliminary of some ideas, and I'm sure all your minds are starting to say, hey, what about this, what about that, more specific type of things. So if you would like, start adding in the chat any questions you may have. I see there's one there. Linda, do you have that one?
I do not see it.
It says on my end, a chat, one chat. Are there any questions?
Hey, Ernie, that may be the one from Denise where she asked everybody to mute their microphones.
Okay. All right. So no questions yet, but can we get into more detail about USP? What do you think is going to be the most difficult part of transition? Everything?
Formulas, because it's going to start with rewriting all your master formulas, you know, because of the BUD changes in both 795 and 797. And in fact, there's a question from Teresa Day that says, can you explain the BUD in 795 where it talks about water content? Do you have to test every compound for water content, or can you generalize?
You don't have to test everyone for water content. There's a table in the chapter that gives you a good reference for if you're doing a lozenge or a liquid or a topical, those kind of things. Kind of gives you a general idea of the water content.
And if you look at
that, I'm sorry.
If you look at that table, there's really only one preparation that comes close, and that's the troche and the PEG base with 3% aqueous flavor. And so as long as you keep your flavor at 3% or less aqueous on those PEG troches, you're going to be fine.
So in regards to all of this, these changes, obviously there's going to have to be a significant amount of policy changes. And that's one of the things that's going to be very difficult for the compounders to to readjust their policies to fit the new requirements. Any ideas on that? Is that something they can start writing now? Did they write? You know, are they going to have it so it's ready for D-Day? Let's say at November 1st.
Well, there's a lot of SOPs to be written. I would highly recommend people went ahead and got started rather than wait till the last minute.
Okay, so there's some more chats I see. I don't see the chats, so I can't read them, but Linda, do you have any?
I do. So Teresa Day also added, but is it water that you add yourself in the formula, or would you say a water-based flavor? Would that count as water content? And since the water-based flavor would have a preservative in it.
Well, I mean, any liquid you put in there, if it's got water in it, you're going to have to figure out how much water is kind of in that that's going to be in your final formulation. If you put one or two drops, how much does that really add?
Well, I think the question goes a little bit deeper here, but I'm not sure.
It does.
We're talking water activity here, not water content. So this is the water that's free for a reaction. And so there's going to be some water free for a reaction in some of your components. But if you're adding water, my guess would certainly be that it's likely going to be free for a reaction. So if you're doing something that's different from what that chart says, if you're taking something that would be a non-aqueous base and then you're adding a bunch of water into that formula, you know, that may put you over the edge and you may need to use those shorter BUDs. But just the water in the flavor, really the only one that comes close is that troche with 3% flavor. And it doesn't even come, you know, it's not like exactly on the border. It's a little bit under. And so that water flavor is fine as long as you don't go over that 3%.
So on the next, there's some more questions. Linda, can you read? I can't see them, so I can't read them.
Danielle says, please summarize the all applicable tests to qualify for Category 3 CSPs in USP 797?
Well, that's a tough question.
That's going to depend on, you know, that's all that stability data, you know, the testing for the stability testing and all that too. So I'm going to refer you to that stability resource document that's on the USP website. And if you go kind of towards the end of that document, it's going to give you recommended tests for both sterile and non-sterile preparations to use as your guidance when you're setting up those stability studies. As far as what's directly in the chapter, you're going to, of course, need to do sterility testing and then endotoxin testing if you're starting from non-sterile starting components. And then if it's a multiple dose container, you're going to have to do that 51 testing. I think it might call out container closure testing in there too, but otherwise I'll direct you to that stability document.
Linda McElhiney also said, I have an announcement. Madiska is doing the USP 51 on all of the stability studies that use their bases, vehicles, and will be done with that testing by November 1st. And she received this information from Phil Smith. So if you are using those formulas, you will not have to do USP 51.
As long as you're doing the formulas exactly the same and using the same container closure system.
Correct. But that's good news.
Yeah, it is.
That should help. Linda, I see some more coming on.
That's the last one I see from Linda McElhiney.
I've got a different number here, but... do you folks have any advice for the future of getting closer to the November date, which obviously is going to go faster than you can expect with all the work that has to be done? Any advice to these folks that are on, and you know, other than you mentioned about you know, starting now, and you know, I like your idea, Lisa, about a little at a time. But is there any other things that you think that could be helpful to them to be more prepared?
Well, the other thing that you just can't be ignoring at this point is 800. Because 800, although it's beneficial all this time, hasn't been applicable, you know, or enforceable until the new 795 and 797 that mention 800. And so November 1st, 800 is also going to be federally enforceable. Some states are already enforcing it, have enforced it from the beginning. But you can't discount that. So maybe your state is not going to adopt it or not going to enforce it, but federally, again, FDA certainly can. And it is about the safety of your employees. And so if you are not ready and do not have, you know, the primary and secondary engineering controls you need and have done that assessment of risk, you're going to be hurting by November 1st. And I think it's really important not to forget that part with all the changes we have in 795 and 797.
And Denise, I would add to that that some states are, the pharmacy board may not be the ones that adopt it. You know, OSHA can come out to your facility anytime, labor boards, if they feel like there's been a violation of any kind, can come out. And that's not something we as pharmacists have been accustomed to, quite frankly. So I think that's one thing people need to be aware of, because you are supposed to be protecting your employees.
There's really nothing in 800 that hasn't been required by OSHA for decades.
Exactly.
It's just that OSHA doesn't enforce things in pharmacies unless there's a problem. You get a pharmacist or a technician that claims they got cancer from workplace exposure, mm-hmm. OSHA will come in and throw the book at you before November 1st, way before that.
I think I could say that all four of us on here, Ernie and you and I and Brenda, have all made chemotherapy back in the day when there was no protection whatsoever.
Absolutely.
And I know, you know, I myself have suffered from some cancer. And is that the because of it? We don't know. But it's out there. It's been out there for a long time. And I chuckled back when I was a pharmacy technician and the first hood came into the pharmacy. And it just had glass and the pharmacist was going to wear gloves and it was vented into the room. And so I have to think, wow, I think we've made progress.
We have. OSHA actually references USP 800, and they've referenced it since just a few months after it got published.
Oh, yeah.
So mm-hmm. It's already there.
It's interesting how far we come, because when pharmacists started getting these hoods, they thought that that was going to sterilize everything and you wouldn't have to worry about anything. Just anything you did in the hood was going to work. So you're right, Lisa. You know, there was we've come a long way, but now we're being watched. So, you know, it's people learned a lot, and now they're trying to use the protective issues that have to be complied with. But another question is, one of the things that we find, and I ask you folks to elaborate on it, is what about people trying to, as far as facility change, to recognize that the facility change is pretty imperative to, the negative pressure type of room. And by starting too late, if you haven't done so at this point, sometimes the equipment, everything becomes, much more difficult to get access to. People are busy. And now with these changes, a lot of folks have to, put in negative pressure rooms, which they haven't had in the past. And equipment shortages and our time to get equipment, the time to get even a HVAC person, I find that's getting really difficult now. Mm-hmm. So how do you feel about that, the impact that that's going to bring?
Well, waiting till last minute is never a good strategy.
Yeah. But at least I think the folks should think about, how, what they might have to do. And there's plenty of clean room and room designers that can, help with that. But certainly plenty of consultants out there. But the matter is, I'd be very aware of some of the equipment and getting people to do the work in time. You can't wait till, September or October, because, these things take time. You could have to get licenses and
the room certified, the hood certified. Right, exactly.
Well, and depending upon what state you're in, you've got to have approval from possibly your state board of pharmacy and your permits, whether they're state or county or city or state board of pharmacy. I mean, there's a lot of questions, a lot of boxes to check when getting prepared.
It all comes down to be prepared now and start working on it now and not wait till later. Everything we're talking about is, that's what, my view is, but, and you guys are certainly, stating that. Linda, you have a couple of more questions in there.
Yes. So Nancy Fingerhut asked, can you elaborate on the impact on CSP formulas that utilize stock solutions?
Brenda, you
want to
take that one?
Yeah, I was going to give that to Brenda.
So this is
a change, but it's not a deal breaker. So think about if you were making a stock solution and keeping it under medium risk. So this would be something like in Lisa's pediatric world. So if you were making a stock solution and keeping it for 9 days, well, the difference now is that actual stock solution, you can still put that original 9-day BUD on it, but once you start using it, you only have 12 hours because there's no preservatives in there. So instead of making, a 500 mil bag and putting that 9-day BUD, you may need to do 5 100 mil bags and then just use, one a shift or whatever, so that we don't end up inadvertently contaminating that bag. Now these stocks, from the non-sterile to sterile end of things, we can make these stock solutions as single dose containers also, and it's going to have that same BUD, 12 hours once opened or once you start using it, which is double what we have now, because right now we only have 6 hours.
Mm-hmm.
David Miller said OSHA can enforce 800 and they are scarier than our state boards or the FDA.
He's got that right.
Yep.
He got that one right. It's no joke. They are, OSHA comes in, there's a guaranteed fine, no matter, just visit, no matter what. But that's a good point, David. Linda, there's more, I think.
Yes. Linda McElhiney asked, are the container closures per brand of container or generally based on what the containers of what the containers are made of? Like the type of plastic.
So from a USP standpoint, it's the materials of composition and not necessarily the exact brand of container. And that's different than what the manufacturers have to do, but it's a little bit looser on the compounder's end of things.
One last question in the chat right now. John Hurst says, what about states that have boards that do not adopt USP 797? For example, Texas, and no adoption of USP 800. New Jersey will be adopting and I will be following, but will this prevent a pharmacy whose state doesn't adopt from shipping into my state?
Okay, there's a couple of issues with this here. So first of all, yes, it could keep you from shipping into another state. The other issue is that even if I'm in Minnesota, and if I get licensed in, you know, to ship things to Texas, and my state doesn't require me to follow 800, really doesn't require me to follow 797, you know, we don't have any of that stuff. And so I don't. And my non-resident license in Texas says, well, you know what, as long as you're okay with your own state and you're following all the rules of your own state, you're good with us. Okay, except that in case law, every single time, if I make something according to my laws and regulations of Minnesota and Texas says I have to follow Minnesota law and the patient's in Texas and something happens, case law shows that they will hold you to those regulations in Texas where that patient is. Those regulations apply despite what it says in the Practice Act. And so and federally, of course, if FDA comes in, you need to be compliant with all of these things. But shipping into other states, you better be compliant with the most stringent law to avoid getting into trouble, no matter what, which means you need to be compliant with all of these things, whether or not your home state requires it.
Well, and I would add to that, Denise, I mean, Texas, I'm in Texas and, you know, there's about eight.
They're actually much more stringent. Yeah.
Yeah. There's about eight places in the Texas law that are more stringent than the current USP 797 chapter. And we don't know what they're going to do either way. The board has been quite silent actually on which, where things are going. But to give an example is I had an out-of-state pharmacist call me and said, what's this deal about hands-free doors in the Texas law? And it's a should in the USP chapter. And I said, it is a should, but it's a must in the Texas chapter. And if you want a license in Texas or to ship into Texas, then you're going to have to go by whichever one is the most stringent. So I mean, there's other states out there. I think New Jersey, John Hurst from New Jersey, I believe, and a couple other states that are more stringent, California, than, you know, the USP chapters. And so, yeah, you got to know where all those little innuendos is. Texas didn't go out and publish a list of what they changed from a should to a must. You know,
no, but they do require current inspections and they deny licenses. And one of them is pass-through. You can't have a pass-through from a buffer room to general areas. You can go from buffer room to anteroom or anteroom to general, but not buffer room directly out to general, which makes sense. But yeah, and they do enforce that for folks that have non-resident licenses that ship into the state.
Absolutely.
So, yep. But even if they didn't, case law shows that they will always side with the regulations of the state in which the patient lives or where the patient got the medication delivered to. So, yeah, you got to follow that most stringent.
You know, I'd like to change course on veterinarians. Now, how does that affect the veterinarian pharmacies USP? You know, there were certain veterinarians were exempt in on a lot of these things. Now, what's the impact that USP is going to bring on veterinarian compounding?
veterinarians and veterinary pharmacy has never been exempted from USP. Now it all boils down to who's going to enforce it, but the boards of pharmacy are going to enforce the veterinary pharmacies. It's up to the veterinary medical board to enforce them. That's not really much different from physicians. You know, a lot of physicians aren't very enforced in their compounding either.
So will they be exempt?
Yeah, will I think 100 is going to be more.
No, they're not exempt. They're included in the chapter.
Yeah. It's all places where all compounded medications are prepared.
I know. It's just I don't know. The veterinarians in the past seem to, not follow any of the impact on compounding. But I don't say all, obviously, but you know, a lot of them that produce their own compounds did not respond to USP. So it's going to be interesting how that transition is going to happen. How can pharmacists help? You know, that's the thing, the kids, you know.
It all boils down to who's regulating you and what they're looking at.
Right. Linda, you've got a couple more, I see.
Let's see. David Miller says, allowing my team to wear earbuds to listen to their music and avoid distraction has resulted in a documented 50% reduction in errors coming from my lab. 795 requires removal of earbuds. It also states the designated person may permit accommodations provided that the quality of the environment and CNSP will not be affected. All accommodations should be documented. Is this an adequate argument to make this accommodation and let my technicians continue to use their earbuds?
Well, I always say, David, that you can document it and you can come up with your policy and whatever. That doesn't mean a regulator is going to agree with you. They may not.
And we don't know how they're going to enforce it yet or what their thinking is.
Yeah. Brenda, I'm sorry, you were having something?
Nope, you did fine.
Okay.
Yeah, but Brenda, was there a specific reason that you remember that they needed to remove earbuds? Earbuds weren't allowed?
Personnel protection from chemical exposure. Because they're going to fiddle with them.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And they're going to contaminate their gloves because they're going to push it back in when it starts to fall out, just like cell phone.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Wow, those are good points. Wow.
I don't think any of us knew how much we really touched our faces until COVID came along. And then we all had to wear masks and we all had an itch underneath there and different things. And, up to that point, you'd just been wearing them in the clean room. And if you wore them for non-sterile compounding, which I did and our staff did, but yeah, it was really interesting to be like, oh, I got an itch, like, you know. And
how does USP affect garbing and, you know, garbing and gowning? So what's is there any direct effect on that other than USP 800? I know
as far as 797 is concerned.
Yes.
Okay, so there was some language change from disposable to low lint, and that was due to COVID, where we sometimes have to reuse garb, as we learned. Category 3 is going to require all sterile garb. Category 1 and 2, other than that change from disposable to low lint, there really isn't any change for them.
Well, and Brenda, I think the other add to that would be that most of the garb is now required to be low lint, the face mask, the hair bonnet. Things that didn't actually call out low lint in the past. Mm-hmm.
And what about USP 800? Any effect on that? Keeping these usual,
That's the same as it's always been. No changes to that chapter.
That's a good help. Again, I just want to get back to how about the do not compound list? I mean, this is it doesn't affect USP, but indirectly, it is part of USP. If you're compounding something you shouldn't, how do you folks feel about that? Is that a trick question? I don't know.
Doesn't really matter how we feel about it. It's what's being enforced.
So, okay, that's the answer. I was just looking for an answer on that one, because there's a lot of questions about do not NIOSH list, that adding all these things continually and being prepared for that to make sure you keep an eye on these lists, because they crop up and people don't, pups the devil type of thing,
Well, one of the things with 800, NIOSH came out early in May with another new guidance, but not the list yet. But one of the interesting things about it is about biologics, because they're not going to be evaluating biologics. And so if you are handling biologics or doing any compounding pursuant to the guidance that allows some limited manipulations you can do with biologics, you're going to need to add them, or you may need to add them to your assessment of risk, and make sure that they're on your list of hazardous drugs, because they're not drugs. They're not considering them drugs. They're considering them biologics. And so that's kind of a little extra hook that we're going to need to watch for in our pharmacies that are handling them.
Denise, do you have any specific recommendations on specific biologics that we know we should be handling as hazardous?
No, but AHFS has a list of biologics that was more extensive, and a lot of folks have adopted that list onto their hazardous drug list instead of the original one in NIOSH. And so that would be a good place to start, because they've already looked at those.
I always tell people, if it ends in MAB, NIB, or NAB, probably need to take a really good look at it.
Well, whether or not you can even compound with it or repackage or whatever, there is guidance out that allows for some limited things. So make sure that you're following the guidance. That's a kind of a tricky spot.
I think the other thing that people need to realize is there are some chemicals that we use to compound with that can be hazardous to people. Maybe they're asthmatic. Say a really strong flexible colloidin, flexible colloidin. There's only one strength, but that ether can really get to people, their lungs. It can cause them to go to sleep, those kind of things. Do you need to be handling that in a biological safety good or as a hazardous drug, or can you just make it out on your counter?
Well, it's not listed as a hazardous, NIOSH, technically you don't, right. But your hazardous drug list and how you handle them is up to you. Right. You can add anything onto that list that you want to add onto that list. And the way you want to handle it, and how you want to handle it, and what kind of controls you want around it. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Some of those odor producing compounds or products, like flexible collodion, do you need a respirator? That's that type of thing. And is OSHA going to say, oh, you guys got to wear a respirator for anything like that? Of course, the acetone and things like that, you would have to, but. Flexible collodion is a good question. I don't know, but it's
but if you're using a hood, you're using a containment hood of some sort, that would do it. But you need to remember, it needs to be on your list.
Probably not of a containment hood of some sort, a containment hood that's vented externally or has a carbon filter, because otherwise it's just going to come back in the room.
Yep, true.
But it'll depend on the quantity they're handling too.
Yeah.
We do have another question in the chat. Is there an absolute ban on any skin exposure when compounding category 3? Our staff look like spacemen, and it takes 20 minutes to guard now because they are supposed to cover every inch of skin.
Yes, there is. And they likely are going to get faster as they get practice at it. But it'll depend, because if they're wearing a coverall, that does take longer to don than a gown. But as far as the top part of things, you can get the hoods, even, the hoods separate, and just pull that hood over and I think they'll get faster as time goes on. What I do want to point out, though, is FDA is really hot on any part of the guarding material touching the floor. So make sure the staff is practicing donning those coveralls and even gowns without letting anything touch the floor.
Yeah, and some of these gowns, you know, the ties are kind of tucked up in them. And when you go to open them up, then those strings, the ties start falling down. And it's really easy when you're a short person like me for them to hit the ground. And then you're out of luck.
Yeah. We know what's going to happen to Dayton and all that, but what do you folks feel that should be concentrated on first? Is there a first thing, or is it...
Rewrite your SOPs. You need to revise them, or you need to purchase them and customize them to your location. Mm-hmm. But you've got to start with the SOPs. If you don't have a good set of SOPs, it's going to be tough to train and to hold people accountable to following the rules. So,
yeah. And then training next, because there are a lot of specific items that need to show training and competency. And a lot of it is probably stuff you're already doing. It's just not documented. So how are you going to get that documented?
Yeah.
That's a good point. If, you know, it's the old story, if it's not documented, it didn't happen, you know. So, you know, that's one thing we've learned a lot. Hospitals are used to that, but, you know, pharmacies are not as used to documenting everything they do. I mean, there are, of course, there's some that do, you know, that are very well aware of that. Linda, there was another one that just came in too. So it's...
Will there be any prohibition on using a sterilization company like Centis for reusable sterile attire, or will it all need to be disposable?
It's perfectly acceptable to use a sterilization company to re-sterilize garb.
Another thing I see is we talked about hazardous, but what about hazardous disposal? Has there been any changes on that in USP? I know OSHA is OSHA, so we know what we have to do with that. However, what about from the USP, USP 800?
USP 800 has not changed, okay? And OSHA doesn't regulate disposal. That comes under EPA. And so people are going to need to look at the EPA laws, and those are federal, but they can also be different laws that are state or county or even sometimes city driven. So they need to take a close look at their area.
And those EPA rules did get updated this last year, or... Last year, they've gone into effect this year, I think.
Yeah, a couple years ago. Yeah.
Yeah, but a lot of states haven't caught up with it. So even though federally there have been some changes to the EPA regulations, you need to check with your state regulation and even county if your county has those regulations. But EPA hazardous waste is not the same as NIOSH hazardous drugs. Not all hazardous drugs are on the EPA hazardous waste list. Not everything that's hazardous waste is a hazardous drug. So you need to know what that difference is to know how to handle them.
Can you speak more about EPA, Brenda? And Brenda, you know, from your point of view, EPA is sort of coming into fold now more than it used to be. But can you just elaborate, you folks, to help the compounders understand that a little bit more?
Well, go ahead, Brenda.
I'm not sure I understand the question.
I was just going to say the EPA document is like 450 pages.
Yeah. So who's going to read 400?
Everything. Yeah.
Well, their fines can put you out of business. So somebody better be reading it.
This is why, though, Ernie, this is why you need to have a hazardous waste disposal vendor. Because you have to be specifically categorized. There is certain paperwork that you have to file. There's all kinds of documentation around the waste and how much. And your vendor will take care of that for you. That's not something you want to try to do on your own because it's very complicated. And with states between state and federal, you know, it makes it really bad. A lot of states now, though, have a specific document that says pharmaceutical waste. So they take that big EPA document, pare it down to what you would see in a pharmacy. And so you look for those, you know, when you're looking at your state regs.
So that's a great thing. They could check with their vendors on how that EPA affects them, you know, what do they do, and understand it a little bit more.
One of the things you don't want to do, though, is ask your EPA hazardous waste vendor for a spill kit. Because a hazardous waste spill kit is a 55-gallon drum with enough stuff to soak up 5 gallons of gasoline. That is not appropriate for a pharmacy. And so you want hazardous drug spill kit, not hazardous waste spill kit.
So does every pharmacy still have to have a hazardous spill kit?
For USP 800, they also need to have a spill kit to take care of non-hazardous spills. That was new in 795, you know, it says specifically.
So that includes having your training also with the spill kit, mm-hmm. to document that everyone has been trained, that always a great kit over there. It looks good, but, you know, I don't know how to use it, you know, so Brenda, that has to be documented also, doesn't it?
Of course. Yep. Of course. So a spill kit for 800 is required in the receiving area and in the compounding areas. Mm-hmm. So you may need multiple spill kits.
Linda, there's another one?
No, not yet.
Okay. So that's spill kit. How does that reflect with deliveries of these products? Is the person delivering the product have to have a spill kit with them?
Oh, they should. I'm not sure if it's required. I would have to.
USP doesn't go as far as delivery.
We don't get that granular. And
it just says to package it in a way that would be protected.
Mm-hmm. You know, certain pharmacies obviously specialize more in the oncology level, especially. That do transfer of those drugs to different facilities. I was wondering if that had if there was a mandate on that.
Whatever your SOP says you're doing.
Right. It looks like the questions are drying up there. So is there anything you folks can add to, you know, things that you may say off, you know, the top of what we've been speaking about, if it could be any help to the compounders? I mean, you know, do what you're supposed to do and do it fast. That's the one thing, right? I mean, that's the important thing. Get going now. But from your own perspective, if you could each, you know, just give your impression of what you think should happen in a priority fashion. I mean, you spoke about it, but now let's do a summary with the audience we have, to let them know what you think.
Well, I agree with Denise and say SOPs are your starting point, because, you know, SOPs allow you to replicate everything you do. You know, someone should be able to pick up that SOP and know how to clean, know how to put together a formula and what the rules are.
I would add any facility changes, get started on any facility changes, figure out who's going to be that designated person, because they're going to be the ones that are going to be a big help in getting the SOPs and training and et cetera all set up.
And get that designated person additional training, additional specialized training, higher level training, so that they're equipped to supervise and ensure compliance.
And you got to have an SOP that tells you what that designated person can and cannot do and how they've been trained, right?
Yep, exactly.
So it all circles back together. You know, Arnie, I use an example of, we had an oven catch fire back during the pandemic. It took us 10 months to get a new oven. And this was not a fancy oven, just because supply chains are so, and they're still wonky. The supply chains are still wonky. And so if you're going to order hoods, or like Brenda said, getting your facility ready, you really do need to be talking to those people that you're going to be getting those CVEs from, or any new, you know, sterile compounding hoods, because the pipeline is stretched at the moment.
Well, it's going to be more stretched now because of the implementation of these new regulations and more enforceable type of things happening. So it's that's what was my comment from my perspective. I see a lot of folks, not ready to make the big change, and they are not ready to realize it does take a while to get equipment and get the engineers or HVAC people to come in. That's the way it is now.
Oh, there's another question about, there's a lot of confusion on qualifications necessary to be a designated person. A lot of pharmacists think it has to be a pharmacist. Can you help with who is qualified? Oh my gosh, some of the best compounding facilities I've been in, there's a technician that's a designated person. This is highly technical. It's not a clinical task. And so, no, you do not need to be a pharmacist. What do you think?
You need to watch state law, though. I think Connecticut requires a pharmacist. So state by state, they may have a different requirement, but I agree. My big problem that I see is that sometimes the person they designate doesn't have the authority to do what needs to be done. So they need to have that authority.
And it can be more than one person. You could have a technician and a pharmacist.
Yeah.
And oftentimes the training, and compliance and competency stuff is kind of separate from the day-to-day operational compliance stuff. And so, separating those types of duties between two people can make them both more efficient.
Well, even if you just choose one chapter, pick one, 795, 797, or 800, one person can't do it all. I mean, you really do need a designated person, some other people to be help train and write SOPs and all those kind of things. I did hear the other day that Tennessee is going to require it to be a pharmacist also.
Wow, that's you folks have brought a lot to the table for our audience, because your experience and expertise on some of the subject matters. A lot of these are questions, people are afraid to ask, but they're questions that have to be asked. And what do you do about them? And you've brought a lot of information. And I feel always privileged to have people like yourselves, that experts in the field, to be able to help the compounders. And we all trying to do it in a different way, of whatever we can do to make sure compounders stay compliant and realize they have to do certain things. But you folks have given up your time, and I appreciate the time that you gave today. That's all meaningful, that it's all your own personal time that you do these type of things. And I know all of you do them on a regular basis. That's the interesting part of it is, for ACA's sake, and I wanted to make sure that you know that we're much appreciated for you to come on board with this and give the information that you've provided to these compounders. Great, great business, and the specialty of compounding is never going to go away as far as I'm concerned. It's just that we have to work with it and be ready for the changes to take place. But with people with the specialties of you folks and the consultant that you can provide is unbelievable. So I thank you very much for attending this and bearing with me on some of the questions I asked. All good, all good. And hope to see you folks soon. And ACA, on behalf of ACA, they appreciate, this is a very large number. You folks have brought a lot of people of interest to hear what you had to say. And there's a lot more, obviously. Can any of you, are any of you willing to offer contact information for these folks if they wanted to get in touch with you in any way, whether it's for consulting or whatever. But if you would like, ACA can follow up with that if you're willing to do that, and they'd be happy to send it out. There's one real quick question that just popped up. Linda, what was that?
It just says real quick.
Real quick. Oh, okay. Well, whatever that means. Again, thank you guys very much. And on Ernie. Behalf of ACA, we'll be speaking more about other subject matter coming up in the next month.
Courtney did put her question in. It says, if you are a non-sterile pharmacy, do you have to abide by 797? And I see Brenda answered it. So.
Great. So I think everyone on the list has gotten the questions they've asked, and I hope you're satisfied with the program and look forward to seeing all of you in the next program.
Thank you, Ernie.
Thank you guys very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks.